Okay, so I got some more Xeroxes for you. So these are, I didn't get a chance to reduce, but you should reuse and recycle. So they're two one-sided sheets, which I try not to do, but this time I failed. I already gave you a couple of these poems, but there are a couple more. So, or there's one more, there are two more, which is why I'm distributing it. Let's start with one of Robert Louis Stevenson's Songs of Travel. So that's on the second sheet, the one that doesn't start The Modern Mother. And thank you. So Stevenson, he wrote A Child's Garden of Verses. We talked a little bit about that yesterday. I really, really, really think that poem, the Envoy or Envoy, about the child of air is great. And just the ambiguity of who the child of air is, which is precisely what the child of air is that he is unreal enough, or she is unreal enough, that you can't be that child. You can't summon that child. The child might be Stevenson, who is remembering his own childhood. It might be you, the reader, to any reader who are remembering your own childhood. But the childhood can't be drawn out of the book. Its only existence is a kind of imaginary or literary existence. So it's a very, very haunting poem in A Child's Garden of Verses. And it's clearly that is not a poem directed towards a child, but except to the extent that it's directed towards a child of air. That is, the child you once were, let's say. The child of air, because that child is now gone. So Stevenson is a really, really, really evocative writer. And people remember him now much more for Treasure Island and for Kidnapped, and for Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. But he was as ambitious as a poet as he was a prose writer, as a tale teller. And it's really, really worth reading his poems, not only in A Child's Garden of Verses, which is the one book that people still remember, but he has a book that he revised and added to and was totally into called Songs of Travel. And so I brought one poem from Songs of Travel, which, as I say, is on the second sheet. So someone want to read it? Let's see, I. So we already did The Eye in Sophia, right? Didn't we do that once?
I don't remember.
Oh, okay. Well, then, no, that's right. We were going to do the Eye. Yeah, we're just doing the same thing over and over again. It's like a poem with a refrain. So we did the Eye in Arena. So this time we'll do the Eye in Sophia. How's that?
Okay. I will make you breeches and toys for your delight, of birdsong at morning and starshine at night. I will make a palace fit for you and me, of green days and forests and blue days at sea. I will make my kitchen, you shall keep your room, where white flows the river and bright blows the broom, and you shall wash your linen and keep your body white in rainfall at morning and dewfall at night. And this shall be for music when no one else is near, the fine song for singing, the rare song to hear, that only I remember, that only you admire, of the broad road that stretches in the roadside fire.
Great, thank you. So it's not a deep poem, maybe, but it's maybe a little bit, its evocativeness is slightly more complex than it might seem at first. Only slightly, but slightly. So how would you describe what's going on in it? Yeah, right.
I would say perhaps there's possibly a theme of purity, because a lot of what I see, especially in the first half of the first stanza and the entirety of the second stanza, is repetition of things with the color white, which, at least in Victorian poetry, seems to indicate purity, you know, sort of cleanliness, wholeness, you know, purity going there too. Yeah.
Okay, and brightness, where do you see white in the first stanza?
Brooches and toys for your delight, a bird song at morning, and stars shine at night, stars of white, and perhaps we could see the bird song as the song of the dove.
Oh, nice.
White bird.
Okay. So, tell me about metaphor in the poem.
I will make a palace fit for you and me of green days and forests and blue days at sea. That if he's making a palace of days in the forest and at sea, then it's not a real palace, it's a metaphor.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so, yeah, Quinn.
He's claiming to be making all these human things, like brooches and toys, but, and you know, a palace. And in the end, all these things are made of things as nature as it gets.
Yes, as nature as it gets.
Yeah,
nice.
So it's almost like introducing nature to somebody and, you know, this idea of, okay, this is the best gift you get.
Yeah. Okay, good. The best, when you say the best gift you get, do you mean the best, or this is the best I can do?
The best.
Okay, yeah. Good. Yeah, I agree. Yeah. Quinn.
So, I promise I'm doing some work, but who's the old country singer that is not Willie Nelson? Who did the important cover of Hurt? Johnny Cash.
I saw him on stage once. Here, I'll tell you a quick Johnny Cash story. I saw him on stage when I was a kid. I really liked Johnny Cash, and then I kind of stopped liking him. And now I really like him again, but I just know I stopped liking him because we went to the local pizza place where I'd listen to a boy named Sue every time we had pizza. And then one time we left and we had 50 cents, which could get you 9 songs at the time. So we put a boy named Sue on 9 times and left. So that was really antisocial of me. But I did see him once, and then someone tried to rush the stage while he was doing, in Madison Square Garden, while he was doing a boy named Sue. And he was stopped, but Johnny Cash was really cool about it and said, you can let him go, he's all right. And then he finished singing the song and he said, I think I'm going to name him after you, instead of saying, I think I'm going to name him Sue. Everyone knows that song, Boy Named Sue? That's like one of the, you don't know it. It's okay. If you go, there's a pizza place where I think it's still playing. Yeah, it's about how... Well, you can get it from the title, but but there's a twist at the end, which is that it was a good thing that he had been named Sue, not a bad thing as he thought. Sorry, go on.
Oh, yeah, I think that's an excellent tie, and I like Johnny Cash a lot, and he has this old song called 'Cause I Love You, and one of the stanzas goes, if we lived in a cottage, it will feel like a castle for the royal way you're treated and attention shown to you. And I think that's like
Same.
Yeah. I was like, he took this from Stevenson.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah.
But it's the same exact sentiment throughout the song as it is throughout the poem, which is, I'm going to build a life for us that makes you feel not just cared for, but attended to.
Yeah, good. Yeah, there's and there's probably a lot of proto-country ideas in this song. You know, me and Bobby McGee, nothing's just another word for nothing left to lose, nothing ain't worth nothing, but it's free. So yeah, now that we have those earworms, or at least I do, that's right. You make a palace of green days and forests and blue days at sea. You probably know that Stevenson did a whole lot of adventuring. He traveled all around the world. He, he died in the South Seas, I think in Hawaii, at a time when, am I right? Are you nodding?
I'm not positive, but that sounds right.
Yeah. And was, he died very young of TB. He was 44, so it may not seem like young to you, but it is. But he did a lot of travel, and the songs of travel, you know, in a sense, he earned them. It wasn't like, is it John Denver who's never been to West Virginia? what's his name? Why am I forgetting his name? The comic who did, during COVID, he did a lockdown special from his garage. Yes, yes. So he has a really good song about a country singer, Bo Burnham.
Oh, yeah.
About a country singer on his plane. Mm-hmm. Yeah. You don't know Bo Burnham either.
I have no idea.
You do? Okay. Is that good? Do you like him? You should.
And then you should really get him.
But he's very talented.
Okay. He's what?
I have mixed feelings about him overall, but he is very talented. Yes.
Okay. Well, fair enough. At any rate, Stevenson did do the traveling that he also writes about, did have adventures that are... So he knows what he's talking about. So, it's a love poem. And what are the brooches and the toys going to be made out of? Yeah, yeah, beautiful things in the sky. Bird song at morning, that's the brooch. Starshine at night, that's the toy. Something to play with, not a children's toy, but something that it would be fun when you're relaxing to be interacting with. So brooches of bird song, toys of starshine. And again, notice just as part of the technical effect, the hyphenated words, bird song, star shine. And then the palace is made of green days and blue days. And the kitchen is made not as explicitly, but made of what? The kitchen and her room? Yeah, so where the waters are flowing and where the broom, the vegetation, is blooming brightly. Blow means bloom in British English. Again, do you remember, Sam, the end of the intimation ode? It's fine if you don't. To me, the meanest flower that blows gives rise to thoughts that lie too deep for tears. So blows there means blooms. So that's where my kitchen will be and where her room will be. So how will his kitchen be where white flows the water? How would that be a kitchen? I think this is like 1.5 on a scale of 1 to 5 in difficulty.
Why would you consider the water to be white?
It just means that white water just means rapidly running water over rocks, like whitewater rafting. But it's not, he's not making the kitchen out of the river. He's making it where the river is tumbling over rocks, is rushing over rocks. So what would it mean? What does that mean? Yeah.
He's making a campsite?
Yeah, it's a campsite. It's a campfire. I'll make your coffee over a campfire. Where? Outside, where white flows the river. And where is her room? Where the broom is blooming brightly. So in the first stanza, it's an explicit metaphor where these natural things are turned into ideas of things. In the second stanza, it's more, I don't know, it's actually slightly less challenging. We will make our bed in the forest on some leaves. You wouldn't have trouble understanding that. And you wouldn't say, but wait, those are leaves, that's not a bed. No, it's a substitute for a bed. It's somewhere between metaphor and metonymy. Do people know what metonymy is? What is it?
Literal change of name.
Literal change of name.
Oh, no, literal. It's a change of name. So it's like when you, I don't know, I can only think of like synecdoche examples. But it's like if you call...
Synecdoche is a kind of metonymy.
Yeah, it's like if you call like a monarch the crown.
Yeah.
Or if you call like a car, like he has nice wheels.
Right, good.
That's a metonymy.
Yeah. Yeah, so it's when you talk about something which is connected to the actual thing you're talking about. So if you say all hands on deck, it's you're not supposed to imagine just hands on deck. If you say the crown looks with displeasure upon the fact that President Biden is not coming to the coronation, then what you mean is the king. Literally, you mean the king. But metonymy is a slight displacement onto something strongly connected with the thing that it's a metonymy for. So metaphors, some people think of metaphors and metonymies as diametrically opposed to each other, because a metaphor is saying X is Y, whereas a metonymy is saying a little part of X is all I need to really say for you to get all of X. And synecdoche, which is part for whole or whole for part, is a special case of metonymy. So it's more like, I will make my kitchen, you shall keep your room. Well, she would have room there. He would be cooking there. So I will make my kitchen, yeah, because it's a place of cooking. It's not like calling Hell's Kitchen in New York City Hell's Kitchen because of all the cooking that's done there. It's called Hell's Kitchen because of how hot, because of it being a very scary place, the way hell is a scary place, and the idea would be hell is hot, Hell's Kitchen is the hottest part of hell. But there's very little of what we think of as a kitchen in the phrase Hell's Kitchen. But here he means a kitchen. It would be a kitchen, but not a standard kitchen. So it's close to metonymy, not quite the same thing, but close to metonymy. And that's a nice shift. So I will make my kitchen and you shall keep your room where white flows the river and bright blows the broom. And you shall wash your linen and keep your body white in rainfall at morning and dewfall at night. Just paraphrase that. This is 1 and 1 to 5. Easy paraphrase. Don't make a big deal out of it.
You can use rainwater and dew water to clean yourself and your clothes.
Right. Good. So notice how that's become literal. That is that we go from metaphor in the first stanza to metonymy-esque language in the second stanza to something literal at the end of the second stanza. You know, there'll be water to wash with, don't worry. It's not, and you shall have your bathroom and your washing machine in rainfall at morning and dewfall will keep you clean. Not bad, right? But no, it's become literal. Yeah, that's how she will wash. So in 8 lines, we go from, you could say we're given a convincing idea of being able to live on the road, not just as a romantic idea, but as something that this is how it would literally be done. It's not like we're supposed to say, wow, it's amazing what a presto change-o transformation he did. But we can just feel that, yeah, it makes sense. It makes sense without needing interpretation. It makes sense without trying to figure out, wait a second, how is Starshine a toy? How is Birdsong a brooch? You know, Birdsong as a brooch makes almost no sense at all. But washing in water by rivers in the rain, that does make sense. So then third stanza, and this shall be for music when no one else is near. the fine song for singing, the rare song to hear. So what's this there? Yes, exactly, this poem. So now, in a sense, we've focused even farther, although it's hard to think how you could at the end of the second stanza, but in a sense, we focused even farther. And then this poem will be this poem. And it's okay, that's good. The fine song for singing, the rare song to hear, that could sound boastful, but I don't think it is. It's just, we'll be happy. And just, we'll be happy singing about our own happiness on the road. That's what will make it a fine song for singing, a rare song to hear. What does rare mean there? All right, so I'm going to quote you a line from Shakespeare. Oh, rare Egyptian. Anyone know who that's about? Yes, good guess. And it's a term of praise. That is, it's like a rare metal. It is, wow, she's amazing. Rarely, to quote Shelley, rarely do we see anything like this. So it means something like precious, almost unheard of. But it also means the other thing that rare means, which is what? The more everyday meaning of rare.
Uncommon.
Yeah, the less rare meaning of rare. Uncommon. So yeah, it's not a song you hear often. Why? Because only I remember it, only you admire it. So the fine song for singing and the rare song to hear that only I remember, that only you admire. The song of the broad road that stretches and the roadside fire. So two things that happen on the road. You move down the road or you stop and you make a fire and you make your campfire. And that's the song of the road. So I think it's just really wonderfully evocative. And all his songs of the road. It's a great book. You can get it. You can find it easily on the internet because it's not copyrighted, obviously. But the whole book is great. And this is sort of typifies Stevenson's just amazing grace as a writer. He's also really amazingly graceful as a prose writer. That's another thing to say about him. Just since we were looking at that, let's look at. Let me just find it quickly. One of the funny poems that we didn't really talk about, we mentioned but didn't really talk about. Have I gone too far? No. Undertones on 521. So we won't read it carefully, and it's not clear to me that it would repay reading carefully, which is most poems do. Maybe this would as well, but we don't really have time. But it's Undertones by a Lunatic Laureate, George R. Sims. There's a feeling that comes with the days of joy and goes with the nights of grief. So, paraphrase?
I mean, there's a lot of purposeful misspelling.
Okay, but is it misspelling, or?
No, it's double meaning, but.
Yeah.
But you're supposed to hear day and night, and then the joy that comes in the day, the grief that comes with the darkness of night, and it's also doubling as, like, metaphor.
Yeah, okay, good, well put. So, and the metaphors are not entirely unlike Stevenson's. So, joy dazes you. Therefore, there's a feeling that comes with the daze, with the dazing of joy. And goes with the nights of grief. So you are supposed to imagine something like nights of grief in the period of courtly love. Yes. You know what Don Quixote is called? What Sancho Panza gives him a name, and then that becomes what he is called throughout. He is the knight of the rueful countenance, because he looks sad one day. So Sancho Panza, his page, says, from now on, I'll call you the knight of the rueful countenance. And he accepts it. So the knights of grief would be like knights of the rueful countenance. So feeling that comes with the days of joy, notice what it does to the word goes, and goes with the nights of grief. If something goes with something, what does that mean?
It's passing.
Well, let's say it goes, if you say it goes with the territory, what does that mean? Having to take an exam goes with the territory of being a student.
It appears well. It's like as a package deal of something.
Right, exactly. It's a package deal. So if something goes with something else, that usually means that it's inseparable from it. If you are doing something, this is going to happen as well. So notice that what he's doing is he's, in a sense, using two ideas of come and go. If something comes and goes, what does that mean? Here, I'll quote Wordsworth for you. The rainbow comes and goes. What does that mean? That's the Intimations Ode. Sam, you're going to be our Intimations Ode target of information.
It's just part of its nature to just appear and disappear.
Yeah. Love comes and goes. The rainbow comes and goes. Democratic presidents come and go. Republican presidents come and go. Yeah. So here he has, there's a feeling that comes with the days of joy and goes with the nights of grief, would mean, if you just heard it, that you have a joyful feeling when the days are full of joy, but it goes away when the nights are full of grief. But it might be saying something else. That is, here's a feeling that when you're dazed, you have. And it also goes with, as in goes with the territory, it goes with the nights of grief wherever they are. They have this feeling as well. So they may be joyful, the nights of grief. They may belong. It may be that as knights errant, they are serving grief, but they have the same feeling that comes with the days of joy. So notice that the puns, days of joy, nights of grief, also have a kind of retroactive effect on come and go and on what that phrase means. It doesn't just mean the rainbow comes and goes, but it might mean come and go might be synonyms of each other here, which usually they're not, but they can sometimes be. Goes with the territory and comes with the territory mean the same thing. So he could be making them mean the same thing. That stands on the top of a baby. Of a baby what?
Boy.
Yeah. So yeah, you want to pronounce it right, but he doesn't want you to pronounce it right. That stands on the top of a baby boy and floats, what's the pun in that line?
With a handkerchief,
right, with an anchor chief. So you can be on the waters. The Knights of Grief might be looking out over the waters, and there they will see the same feeling somehow on top of a baby buoy, a baby boy. And floating with the most important anchor of a boat, but also baby boy and handkerchief, etc. So if you just look at then at the end of that poem, remember the fate of the ready-made. So what's the pun on ready-made? Make it one word.
Milkmaid?
Like, no, it's spell made, M-A-D-E. So a ready-made is something that is essentially the opposite of custom-made. you can get a ready-made shirt. And sometimes it's used simply as a noun. I think actually Warhol may have used the word about a lot of his reproduced art. He called them ready-mades. Remember the fate of the ready-made. So the pun is on ready-made. Who went where the preachers pray. What's the pun there? Yeah. So, yeah, these are preachers that are not doing what preachers are supposed to be doing, which is praying, because instead they are praying on. And who are they praying on?
Well, I mean, if you think of it as a stereotype today, that's still pretty accurate.
Yeah, yeah. And so who would they be praying on in these two lines? They'd be praying on the maid, the ready maid, who went where they are praying on people. So look what happened to her. They preyed on her. She was interested in sex, and they took advantage of her interest and preyed upon her. Take matter for thought from a new decayed. So something new has decayed, but the pun is?
Decade.
Decade, right. And the English pronunciation of decade is actually decayed. It's one of those things, if you go to England, you don't know what they're talking about for a minute.
Is it still this way?
Yeah. Oh. Yeah. Now, there are a lot of... One interesting thing about, I think, the history of poetic meter is when... How do you say it in Canada?
Decade.
Decade, yeah. One interesting thing about the history of poetic meter is that... And of rhyme, for that matter, is that lines that we know are metrical are actually pronounced differently... As the centuries pass, and B, as you go, as the language changes geographically, and but you will internalize their meter as being correct, even though you're not saying it the way the poet originally thought it, and that will expand the possibilities of meter, which is a cool thing. So take matter for thought from a new decade, tomorrow succeeds today. So which is the lunatic laureate's refrain in this poem. But it's in some ways that those transformations are like a crackpot version, hence the lunatic laureate, like a crackpot version of what Stevenson is doing in Songs of Travel. Okay, let's take a look at Alice Meynell, who I think is really wonderful. And let me just see if I can find it out. Oh, I should also tell you while we're finding this that so Jeff Nunakawa is going to come to our class on May 1st, and we are going to meet in Schiffman. I think it's Schiffman 201, not where the class used to be. So I will remind you of this, but he's going to come and talk about Wilde, and he's written a couple of books on Wilde, and you'll like him. Okay, so Alice Meynell, page 516, and I think she's a really amazing poet. She converted to Catholicism in, like lots and lots of late Victorian poets, following Cardinal Newman, whom we talked about a little bit, in 1868. One of the poems that we're going to do, that we're going to look at by her, the one called Renouncement, which is on the sheet that I gave you today, it's a sonnet, it's a poem that she wrote after her conversion. John Ruskin, whom we talked about a little bit, remember he's the guy who wrote the book Modern Painters, and was absolutely decisive in getting people to see how great Turner was. Turner, maybe the greatest English painter ever. There are very few who are his equal. And Ruskin, He's a really, really important art critic, social critic, thinker. There are a couple of poems, or there's one poem by him in this book, which is meh. He was also a really good drafts person. He sketched and painted really well, but not at, you know, not at the highest levels. And he realized that he wasn't as good as the truly great. But it was because he was as good as he was that he could see what people like Turner were doing. At any rate, he loved this poem. And the poem Renouncement. And just, it's as I say, it's not that great a poem, but it is worth just looking at briefly. So it's a sonnet, and it is essentially written for the Catholic priest. All we know about him is his name was Father Dignam, who helped convert her, but they both acknowledged that they were really, really attracted to each other. So there is in her mind an idea that there is some erotic motivation for her conversion, which, because she's converted, is also really troubling to her. So that's a fact about her biographically. So just look, just going through a renouncement quickly. I must not think of thee, and tired yet strong, I shun the thought that lurks in all delight, the thought of thee, and in the blue heaven's height, and in the sweetest passage of a song. So whatever she's taking delight in, she's thinking of him. Oh, just beyond the fairest thoughts that throng this breast, the thought of thee waits hidden yet bright. But it must never, never come in sight. I must stop short of thee the whole day long. So that's the octet of the Petrarchan sonnet that is this sonnet. So now we have the sestet. And the volta, the turn. But when sleep comes to close each difficult day, when night gives pause to the long watch I keep, and all my bonds I needs must loose apart, must doff my will as raiment laid away. So as she's falling asleep, she relaxes. She has to, in order to sleep. And she has to relax her will, doff my will, take off my will, as raiment laid away. So an interesting metaphor, that her will is like clothing, which is confining her. Then, when sleep comes, with the first dream that comes with the first sleep, I run, I am gathered to thy heart. So she knows what she's renouncing, in a sense, is the point of the poem. That what makes her conversion serious, what makes anyone's conversion to Catholicism serious, and this is just part of Catholic thought, so I'm not saying any conversion to anything, but it's a particular part of Catholic thought, is that it should be hard, is that you should feel the difficulty and should feel guilt about the difficulty that you're feeling in the renunciation that you're making. And so the very thing that makes it hard makes it good, but the very thing that makes it good also makes you wary just because you're thinking that it's good. And there's a potential element of sadomasochism there, or pure masochism, sadism directed against the self. But it's what makes it real. It's a kind of guarantee that it's real. And that you can feel, as I say, it's not a great poem. And this is not the poem you should use to give you your sense of her. We're going to look at a few other of her poems. Quinn.
I just kind of want to know more about the movement towards Catholicism for the Victorian poets, because it's really interesting, and I kind of understand where she's coming from because of this relationship she had, but it also seems quite not very much like the poet to head towards a confining and sort of restrictive religious system.
Yeah. So, and it's something that we've seen in several poets. Christina Rossetti is one. Hopkins would be, the most major of the poets who converted. So there was something called the Oxford Movement. You know about that, right?
Yep.
Do you want to say more about it? Say more about it.
I don't know what I would say, I guess. There was a point when a lot of people at Oxford kind of just stopped taking the Church of England seriously, and they wanted this kind of move back towards the medieval kind of model of the church, not in necessarily
which is what you work on.
That were yes, this is what yeah. I'm interested in. Which is not to say that it was like a lot of the things that the not the I guess the, I don't know. I'm trying to think of like specific things. It wasn't necessarily. I feel like they thought that there was like something real to that like the Church of England had somehow kind of like lost, and that they kind of didn't really feel like it had, like, I don't know. I don't have a lot of brain cells.
Yeah. Okay. So yeah. So basically, it's another way maybe that you could think of Victorian modernization. So everything, and it's still true that everything, that England is officially a Christian country, and by Christian, that is to say Anglican, there's something called the Church of England, also called the Anglican Church, and, or the Episcopal Church, but that's if you're not in England. And the head of the Anglican Church is the monarch, and the most important person with an actual religious office is the Archbishop of Canterbury. Mm-hmm. And so as England modernizes, you could say it's the nation and the Anglican Church, you know, they're right there with it. Mm-hmm. And they're not so much a counterweight. They're not so much a thing that modernization has to cope with.
Mm-hmm.
They're what's modernizing. That's what the nation is doing. Mm-hmm. But then there are various kinds of nonconformists. So one example is Browning. We didn't talk about this at all. But Robert Browning was from a nonconformist background and family and couldn't get an Oxford degree for that reason. It used to be the case that you had to, if you were nonconformist, there were certain things that were not open to you. I don't think that's still true, but it's only fairly recently that it stopped being true. And so most of the nonconformists were more radically Protestant than the Church of England. And they thought the Church of England was a mirror of what Protestantism or Protestantism was protesting in the Catholic Church, in Geneva, in Germany, in the Netherlands, and so on. But that what you were, and so the English Civil War was between the Puritans and the Church of England. Milton was on the side, was against the Church of England. And this is something, you know, if you think of Methodism, if you think of the Pilgrims, coming to North America, if you think of Quakers, they were all nonconformists, and still are. But then there's another. So basically, if you were somewhat radical as a Christian, your radical views in England were a rejection of the Church of England, would take the form of a rejection of the Church of England. So Cardinal Newman, or John Henry Newman, who wrote a famous autobiography about his own spiritual life, was against the standard Anglican church and grew more and more radical until finally he converted to Catholicism. He was essentially the leader of this movement of people who thought that the church was just becoming, was just decoration for what the country was doing, what the nation was doing, and was not sufficiently rigorous religiously. And finally, what that meant was becoming Catholic and seeing the pains of religion, let's call it, the painfulness of renunciation. And he was extremely influential, and lots of people were his fellow travelers or his followers, and found in a commitment to Catholicism, especially in England, where there weren't priests and Catholic churches everywhere, and where you weren't in sync anymore with the government the way you would be, let's say, in Italy or France. They found in that considerable emotional challenge, considerable spiritual challenge, and they embraced it. They embraced the challenge. And it may not be surprising to find that in a poet, because poets are also embracing the poetic form, and religious form and poetic form in some ways. In someone like Hopkins, the very idea that we talked about of in stress, you know, stress is an aspect of meter, and stress is an aspect of psychology, and stress is an aspect of your relation to the world. And so just the difficulty of poetry for those for whom it's difficult, and it's not always the case, but often the case, that the greatest poets are those for whom poetry is most difficult. Those who can write poetry easily are really good. The more easily they can write it, the gooder they are. But the really great poets are the ones who are pushing really hard against something that's pushing back really hard, who are at grips with something difficult. So the idea of renouncement, the idea, let's say, well, the idea in Freud is going to be called sublimation a little bit later. So do people know what the word sublimation is, what that means? You've all heard it, but yeah, right.
I believe it's a science term that means a solid being transformed straight into a gas.
Right, yeah. And Freud is using it in something like, or his translator is using it in something like the scientific term. So sublimation is what dry ice does. You never get liquid carbon dioxide if you have dry ice. But for Freud, it means that sexual desire is turned into something idealizing, in not idealizing a person, but idealizing a task. So you really are moved by erotic need. But what you do with that is you figure out the benzene ring, or you figure out Fermat's Last Theorem. You figure out what Sophie German primes are. You use this impulse, this need, this pressure that you're feeling within yourself. And Freud basically said, when you have desires that you can't admit, this is the theory of repression, they will come out one way or another. And the way they come out in most cases will be bad for you. And you'll produce symptoms of various sorts. So that the reason you would go see a psychoanalyst is to figure out why you're always screwing yourself up the way you are. And you will find out when you talk to the psychoanalyst what the things that you're repressing that are coming out in the way you're screwing up, what those things are, and that's supposed to help, finding out what the truth is. But Freud says sublimation actually works. You don't need to go see a psychoanalyst about sublimation. That sublimation is repurposing this unconscious repressed pressure into creating something powerful and worth it. So in a sense, what she's saying and what is part of a lot of Catholic thinking is that the very painfulness and difficulty of repression leads to salvation. It leads to strength of character, strength of soul, experience. And this goes back to Augustine. Maybe it goes back to Job. But it goes back to the idea that it should be hard to be a believer. But that the fact that it's hard is good. The fact that you're finding it hard, but you're still doing it, is good. Renunciation should be hard. And so that's what she's writing about there. But what's, I think, interesting and important about Meynell is not that she is representative of a certain movement. It's interesting and important that she does overlap with, let's say, Hopkins, with Coventry Patmore, who's another person who converted. Do you remember the poem we did by him? We did it, I think, the first day of class. The truth is great and shall prevail when none care whether it prevail or not. A very bitter poem. So her overlaps with them are really interesting, but it's also really interesting to see someone who thinks of motherhood all the time. She had, I forget how many children, but she had a lot of children. She thinks about the difficulties of motherhood all the time. That's something Freud talks about as well. There's a caricature version of Freud, which I'm not working really hard to push against. But I'm also want to warn you that it's wrong. But one of the great things that Freud says is essentially there's nothing more difficult than being a mother. And that the amazing thing is he had lots of patients who felt guilty about their ambivalence about their children, about their anger at what their children were demanding from them. Just everyday demands, like crying, staying up late. It's taken over my life. And then they would feel guilty. And Freud said that guilt, he's basically saying, but not quite saying, don't feel guilty. Because if you say don't feel guilty, then the guilt won't do the work that Freud says it does. But the work that Freud says guilt does is to cause the guilty person through that very guilt to feel even more strongly the love that they feel guilty for not feeling strongly enough. So it just flips. The guilt is, they feel guilty for not loving enough, and the result of that is that they recognize in their guilt a modality of love. If they really didn't love, they wouldn't feel guilty. And that, for Freud, is really, really important. But that idea of guilt and love going together, you could see that as a Catholic idea as well. That's the whole idea, is we're supposed to feel guilty because of original sin. To be a fallen human being. If you don't feel guilty, that's bad. But if you do feel guilty, if you feel that renunciation is hard, that's good. That is where the possibility of hope lies. But so what's important about Meynell, again, let me stress, is not that she is a Catholic poet. I mean, she might think that's what's important about her. But it's not that she's a Catholic poet, but that she is a understanding, or the same thing that made Catholicism something she thought about really hard is what made motherhood something she thought about really hard. And I should also tell you, she lived till 1922, I think, and she was a pacifist. Yeah, 1922. She was a pacifist during World War I. She was really, really, really upset about the war and about all the young people killed in the war. Right.
Oh, sorry.
So just to take a relatively easy poem of hers, look at the one called The Modern Mother. Oh, what a kiss with filial passion overcharged is this. To this misgiving breast the child runs as a child ne'er ran to rest upon the light heart and the unoppressed. I'll read the whole thing. Oh, what a kiss with filial passion overcharged is this. To this misgiving breast the child runs, as a child ne'er ran to rest upon the light heart and the unoppressed, unhoped, unsought. A little tenderness this mother thought the utmost of her meed. She looked for gratitude, content indeed, with thus much that her 9 years' love had bought. Nay, even with less. This mother, giver of life, death, peace, distress, desired, not so much thanks as forgiveness, and the passing touch expected, and the slight, the brief caress. Oh, filial light strong in these childish eyes, these new, these bright, intelligible stars. Their rays are near the constant earth, guides in the maze, natural, true, keen, in this dusk of days. So a little bit hard, but not that hard, to paraphrase. So what happens? There's an event that happens, which prompts this poem. Yeah. How old is the child?
9.
Yeah. So her 9-year-old child kisses her. And she's amazed. So, and is that kiss perfunctory?
What do you mean by perfunctory?
Is the child just saying, oh, there's mom, mwah. Or is she saying, okay, you can go play, but first.
Oh, okay. Was filial passion overcharged?
Yeah. So, what's happened?
The child kisses her really emotionally.
Yeah, so out of nowhere, the child just shows absolute love with this kiss. Her son just shows absolute love with this kiss that he gives her. Completely unexpected. Loves her in a way that she couldn't imagine that anyone would love her that much. Just for that instant. It's not, yes, every moment I'm feeling that love, but it's, here is a moment of that love. So, oh, what a kiss with filial passion overcharged is. Filial means what?
Parent to child.
Yeah. Fils and fille in French, son and daughter. So the passion of the child. What a kiss with filial passion overcharges this. To this misgiving breast the child runs. Which misgiving breast? Part of what's a little hard about it are the two thises. with filial passion overcharged is this, to this misgiving breast. But what does she mean by this misgiving breast? Who has misgivings? Yeah, she does. So her breast is full of misgivings, but the child runs. As a child ne'er ran to rest upon the light heart and the unoppressed. So the child runs to her misgiving breast as it would never run to someone who had a light heart and unoppressed. So somehow what's the child sensed? If it would never run to a light heart as it runs to that misgiving breast, what is the child sensed?
It's heavy-hearted, so it's just like she senses her, the mother is not happy.
Or has misgivings, is worried, mm-hmm. is watching the child, and is worried. They grow up so fast. You've all heard that, right? So, but the child, without even thinking about it, runs to kiss her. In an access of love, but not the painful love that she feels for the child, but nevertheless an absolute love, because the child sees she needs it. Doesn't even get that she needs it. Sees that she needs it, let's say, without thinking, oh, she needs this. So there's no gap between the child's impulse and its thought. It's not, oh, I'd better kiss her because I see she's sad. Which, you know, we all know after the age of 9, we all will sometimes fake it with people we know need us to fake it. You know, and just fake it a little bit. The very fact that we're willing to fake it means it's not fake. Mm-hmm. But it does mean that there's a little bit of a gap between what we are acting out and our own self-observation of the fact that we're acting it out. Just a touch of a gap, but here there isn't any of that. The child sees she needs the kiss and gives it to her without thinking, oh, I'd better give it to her. I'll just put down my top for a minute, but I look forward to picking it up again. Why does the child give it to her? Because he loves her. Unhoped, unsought. A little tenderness this mother thought the utmost of her meed. There should probably be a period there. So what did she think would be the most she would get from the child? A little tenderness. Yeah, try a little tenderness. So she thought that's all that that would be the utmost that she would get. She looked for gratitude. Content indeed with thus much that her 9 years' love had bought. So if the child were grateful to her, like Cordelia to King Lear, who says, you've begot me, bred me, raised me, I return those duties as are right fit, she shows gratitude towards her father, and the mother would have been content if the child were grateful and then paid it forward. I mean, that's a standard thing you're supposed to say. Yeah, kids are not going to love you the way you love them. But remember, you didn't love your parents the way they loved you. But that's part of the whole thing. But here's this stunning moment that she didn't expect. She would be content, nay, even with less. So even with less than gratitude, even with less than a little tenderness, nay, even with less. This mother, giver of life, death, peace, distress. Okay, what is surprising in that line? That is a crucial line.
Giver of death.
Yeah, giver of death, giver of distress. Yeah, so if you have a child, you are giving it life and peace, hopefully, if you nurse it asleep. But you're also giving it death and distress. To bring a child into the world is to bring a mortal being into the world, someone who will die. So she desired, not so much thanks for the life and the peace, but forgiveness. That's the most she thought she could get from a child. Do you ever wonder if you should forgive your parents for your existence? No antinatalists in this class? Okay, it is.
I'm pleading the fifth.
Yes.
Whenever my dad and I get in arguments in the car, he always ends it by saying, "I made you."
Oh, okay.
So that's always the end of the argument.
But you have never said, "I didn't ask to be born."
No.
Oh, well, that's good. I'm glad to hear it. You're narrowing your eyes.
Coming from a Chinese family, we never really talk.
Oh, okay. Well, so here she's feeling guilty for bringing a child into a world where it will die. So she desired not so much thanks as forgiveness. And she expected, in the passing touch, expected in the slight, the brief caress. But what does she get? Ophelia, light strong in these childish eyes, these new, these bright, intelligible stars. Like, that's just amazing. Their rays are near the constant earth, guides in the maze, natural, true, keen in this dusk of days. So she can follow his eyes even in the dusk of her days as she's getting older, as she's facing mortality. Won't quite say facing death, but facing mortality. But it's a dusk that, you know, she knows he will undergo as well. But nevertheless, there he is, perfectly, purely there, without any misgivings, without any reticence. And that's amazing to her. And you could ask what the title means, but I think ultimately it doesn't mean what mothers are like in 1875. I think it means what mothers are like in the present, whatever that present is. Every age thinks of itself as the modern age. And so the modern mother is the mother who now remembers a time that's no longer the case. So I am telling you what I think the title means. This is what things are like now. Now in the dusk of days, now knowing that the child will die. All right, let's look at one more poem of hers. Just briefly, The Cradle Song of Twilight. We won't read it carefully, but that's an amazing poem, page 517. The child not yet is lulled to rest. Too young a nurse, the slender night so laxly holds him to her breast that throbs with flight. He plays with her and will not sleep. For other playfellows she sighs. An unmaternal fondness keep her alien eyes. So Cradle Song, like all cradle songs, it's about unhappiness or aggression. The cradle will fall, the bough will break, the cradle will fall, and down will come cradle, baby, and all. What'd you say?
I said down will come baby, cradle, and all.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's another Freudian moment. That is that so many lullabies are extremely violent. But they're sung in a soothing tone. So it allows the parent, or the babysitter, if you've ever babysat, it allows the expression of violent content without it doing any harm to the baby. So there's a feeling that you get that you're not quite allowed to say. So here it's night itself who is unable to get the baby asleep. But just that line, and her alien eyes, an unmaternal fondness keep her alien eyes. She's interested in something else. Night itself is. But okay, let's look at the poem called Parentage, which has an epigraph, which I believe is by Meynell itself. So it's at the bottom, it's right under Renouncement. So the epigraph is, it looks like it's a quotation from something, but I don't think it is. When Augustus Caesar legislated against the unmarried citizens of Rome, he declared them to be in some sort slayers of the people. What would that mean?
Killer of the people.
Sorry?
Killer of
the people. Yeah, why? Why are the unmarried citizens slayers of the people, killers of the people?
Because they aren't producers of people.
Yeah, because population is crashing. Yeah. It's becoming an issue again. I don't think it should be, but it is. So he is saying, if you don't have children, you are destroying the Roman people. So then she says, ah, no, not these. These who were childless, are not they who gave so many dead onto the journeying wave? So these people who are not, who don't have children, whom Augustus would have called slayers of the people, she's saying, no way. Not these. These who were childless are not they who gave so many dead onto the journeying wave, the helpless nurslings of the cradling seas. Not they who doomed by infallible decrees unnumbered men to the innumerable grave. So childless people didn't do that. So who did? But those who slay our fathers, theirs are armies. Death is theirs, the death of innocences and despairs, the dying of the golden and the gray, the young and the old. The sentence, when these speak it, has no nay. You can't contradict this sentence. If you have a child, you are consigning that child to death. The sentence, when these speak it, has no nay. And she who slays, so it's not only men, this is not only, yeah, men starting wars, this is Putin, this is anyone who thinks it's okay to start a war, but it's even more elemental than that. And she who slays is she who bears. So it's the mother who, by having a child, consigns that child to death. Yeats has that line, what young mother a shape upon her lap would, if she could see that child with 60 winters on its head, think him a compensation for his birth or the deep uncertainty of his setting forth. But she's saying, she who bears the child and she who slays is she who bears. What's the second who bears there? She who bears, who bears.
Guilt to blame the responsibility.
Sorry, say it again.
The guilt to blame the
responsibility.
The responsibility.
Okay, good. Quinn.
Yes, that and then bearing children.
Yeah, so she who bears children bears the agony of guilt and responsibility. And of knowing that this being that didn't exist but who now does exist and whom she loves more than anyone will die. So she is the cause of the person's existence and therefore of its non-existence. And she has to bear that. And in a sense, if that's your view and you're a mother, you might have to be Catholic, is what she's saying. Because that is part of the combination of love and guilt and commitment. Because be fruitful and multiply, have lots of children, that's the Catholic rule. And by having lots of children, you are bringing, to quote John Milton, death into the world. And
so
all our woes.
So you're a murderer if you don't have kids. But you're a murderer if you do have kids.
Well, Augusta says you're a murderer. She doesn't agree. But she thinks, you know, there could be a kind of... it's really hard to know whether it's worth it to be alive, to be born for her. And it is, the fact that it's hard to know is a really important fact about life.
Is there any comfort for her in sort of the Catholic / all Christian thought that having Christian children makes them inherently saved?
No, not for her. I think for lots of people, yes, but I don't think for her. No, I think she's, I really do think she's an amazing poet, and it's partly that she is so open-eyed and clear-eyed about her own psychological agony, about the pain of others, and in particular the pain of children. So she's unnervingly powerful. Okay, see you all on Monday.
Can I have the first half of this again?
Oh, did you not get it?
So I only kept one piece.
Yeah,
I
mean,
oh.
I've been looking all over when you wrote that first line.
Sorry.
Okay.
Remember the reduce, yeah. Reuse, recycle joke that I made?
Yeah.
Okay, have a good weekend, everybody.
Good too.